This is Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This is another program in our monthly series about issues of land use, water and energy resources, and the food industries on the Twin Forks of Long Island. Today's Sustainable East End is a reprise of my conversation with farmer and poet Scott Chaskey about his book Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, published by Rodale Press in 2014. I talked with Scott Chaskey, manager of New York's first community-supported agriculture organic farm, the Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett. The farm is owned by the Peconic Land Trust, an organization devoted to preservation of farms and open space on Long Island's East End. Scott Chaskey, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. This is a wonderful book, a beautiful book, very much written in the sense of both your vocations, that is, as a farmer and a poet. You talk about how a seed is a book, but also how a seed is a poem.
What I wanted to get across in this book, firstly, has to do with the magic and the mystery of seeds, or the poetics of seeds. And this is such a crucial topic right now. I had to talk about the politics, and also I wanted to present the promise of it, but I really wanted it to start with the poetics of seeds. And to me, that really, simply stated, has to do with the mystery of the evolution of seeds and what seeds mean to us in the world. And there it is. That's what I began with.
You say that our entire food supply is the gift of the angiosperms. Tell us a little bit about that evolution. What is an angiosperm? How did they come about?
You know, the first seeded plants were the gymnosperms, and I have to go back because I forget the exact years, but say it's 260 million years ago. It wasn't until 140 million years that the angiosperms arrived. The story that I love about that is Darwin's expression that he called it abominable, that because he couldn't explain where they came from. Where did these seeded plants come from? Because a gymnosperm does not flower. So it's you know, the angiosperm is an encased seed, and it can travel further, and, you know, and it's not only reproducing by, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of pollen grains wafted on the wind. So it's a more exact process. And, you know, if Darwin couldn't guess where that came from, you know, we can't either. But it happened. And so when the flowering plants arrived on the world, it would be, I mean, obviously this happened over many, many, many years, but it was really a tremendous transformation of what was possible on the earth.
And why is that? I mean, the gymnosperms are like the ferns.
The ferns are spore plants, so they came before, and the gymnosperms are the evergreens, basically, and the conifers. And so just think of a cone. So when, you know, if you want to think of a gymnosperm, and although they've had tremendous success on the earth because there are, you know, forests everywhere, you know, of gymnosperm plants, the evolution of the seeded plants brought a whole kind of explosion of insects and animals, and ultimately us. So until that happened, until there was, you know, the food being produced,
food
exactly. Being produced by plants, you know, it was a slower process that was happening on the earth.
You mentioned also the politics, which is an important part of your book, and it has very much to do with the struggle over diversity, I think, of seeds and the need to preserve the diversity of seeds. What's happening to seed diversity, and why is that so important to maintain?
Well, it's really You know, biodiversity is sort of the key word, biodiversity, and that's used over and over again in the book. And I do draw on some really great books in writing Seed Time. There's one I want to mention that's sort of the key book to read about the importance of diversity, and that's a book called Shattering by Cary Fowler. It's an amazing book, and written in 1989, maybe something like that, and where he says that we're in the midst of a mass extinction event in agriculture, and that was, of course, written, you know, 20 some years ago. Increasingly, we're still in that. And it really has to do with at a time where we need to increase diversity so that there's more of a chance to for us and plants to adapt to climate change, we're going in the other direction. And so, of course, if you're talking about the lack of diversity in agriculture, in large-scale industrial agriculture, you're talking about monocropping, and there have been disasters having to do with, an insect or a disease problem affecting one type of plant. It turns out, if you followed this back into, say, that there was a corn blight in the 70s, and it turns out there were six different parents, you know, of all the corn plants being planted on a large scale in this country, and it was an incredible disaster. If you go back further, the Irish potato famine was caught because the potatoes being brought from South America, all the potatoes planted in Europe came from two parents, and then it took many after the blight hit, which was devastating, not only just in Ireland over that, everyone knows about that, but in fact it was the blight spread all throughout Europe and went on for 40 years or more, and then it took breeders a lot of time to breed resistant varieties, etc. So the thing is, if you take away diversity, you're narrowing your chances. Our own chances as humans and the chances of all other life of being able to adapt and to change as we need to, as part of living, basically.
Talk a little bit about the birth of the potato and the conditions under which it evolved into an incredible variety of potatoes in its native land. It's a kind of an object lesson to us.
Yeah, I mean, the birthplace is in the Andes, and there's still, 3,000 or more varieties that are grown there, perhaps more than that. I don't know. This is a figure that I read. And, the diversity arises from a grower, a plants person, an indigenous farmer wanting a certain trait. Or a certain taste, making adjustments in plants, and one village making, the farmers in one village learning about a particular variety and wanting to produce a variety of their own, and then over a great period of time, there's a diversity of plants that are, bred by humans and that also come from an interaction with wild plants, et cetera. And so, carefully, potatoes, I don't know how many thousands of years it took to evolve, that many varieties. But when the potato was discovered, I mean, it's probably very telling about the kind of process because, it was discovered in a process of conquering. Right. And so the conquerors took the potato to Europe. It wasn't accepted right away. It took quite a long time. There's some really great stories about how potatoes spread. But once they did, the fact is that humans could actually, it's a very complete food. And so with the addition of a little bit of calcium from milk, people could survive and be fairly healthy, on potatoes and dairy, basically. And so that's basically what happened in Ireland.
if we faced the same thing today, which in some ways we do, because I know there's a wheat rust that's affecting crops, would we even have the flexibility to develop?
Well, we don't. I mean, we don't have that flexibility. There's less and less. And that's why, you know, Kerry Fowler made the statement about the mass extinction event, because if you're extinguishing your ability to create new varieties, then you're narrowing your chances, basically, and that's where we are. So we have to go in the other direction.
Talk about the difference between hybrid seeds and open pollinated seeds, and what are the pros and cons of them?
So open pollinated plants plants that reproduce freely and on their own. Hybrid plants are plants that are where, you know, we have intervened and ultimately, although hybridization is ultimately, it takes place in nature as well. There's natural hybrid process. The hybrids that have created somewhat of a problem in the kind of industrial agriculture that is most common today have to do with breeders inbreeding, so taking two inbred lines and coming up with a plant that produces something called hybrid vigor, and therefore is more reliable, and at least for 1 year, the gardener knows what to expect, etc. But the gardener or farmer then has to go back to the breeder or the seed company to purchase that same seed. There's nothing particularly wrong with that that process. And as I say somewhere in the book, I say hybrids are not inherently evil, and we use many hybrids. The thing is, open pollinated plants lead to more diversity, right? So and there are many different ways that breeders use open pollinated plants, breeders can come up with new varieties that is a different process than the hybrid process, etc. But it's the fact that we're eliminating, you know, the diversity by producing more and more hybrids, and by specializing in creating seeds that then farmers and gardeners have to return again and again to the source, instead of creating more diversity by planting open pollinated plants. That's really the problem.
You're listening to Sustainable East End. We're talking with Scott Chasky of the Peconic Land Trust's Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett about seeds and his new book, Seed Time. How did the development of genetically modified crops or seeds, how did this break Seed Time?
Well, because up until genetic engineering process came into existence, we, even through hybridization or different other breeding techniques, we weren't crossing species lines. So it was no one, you know, until the genetic engineering broke in the 20th century, no one had thought of, you know, breeding a fish gene into a tomato, which is what happened with the first genetic engineered vegetable crop to come onto the market, or breeding a pig with a potato. This sounds absurd, but in fact, this is what happens in genetic engineering. It's actually genes from different species are inserted into the genetic makeup of one to the other. That's just an entirely different process. And oddly, the proponents of genetic engineering have said, well, you know, we've been breeding this and that for forever, and you know, we've been altering plants. And yes, we have, but we have not altered plants by inserting genes of another species into it. So that's just a whole new a whole new universe, basically.
This has been a huge issue for organic farmers that you talk about, because organic farmers, in order to have a crop be certified organic, it cannot have any genetically engineered seeds in it or engineered qualities to the crop, to the food. And you've had genetic drift of GMO corn that has contaminated, corn pollen carried on the wind that has contaminated fields nearby that were owned by organic farmers. And they brought suit against Monsanto, which has developed this corn. The organic seed, I don't remember the exact name, but the organic...
Osgata. It's Osgata. I'm sorry, I can't remember the acronym now, too. But
yeah, but anyway, the Organic Seed Organization, and they lost in court. The judge said that they didn't have standing to sue Monsanto. Explain this judgment, and why do you think it came about?
Ultimately, as explained by C.R. Lawn, who I quote a number of times in the book, who's one of the founders of Fedco Seeds, his explanation was the judge simply did not understand the issue.
Monsanto has been suing farmers who did not buy Monsanto seeds, but have found that their fields have been contaminated by Monsanto seed that other farmers have planted.
Yes.
So they've sued Monsanto. The company has sued them for violation of intellectual property rights. And these farmers were then trying to say, no, we are suing Monsanto because we want to forestall its ability to sue us.
Yes, basically.
I see. So then what about the case of farmers who are organic farmers like yourself, whose food may be contaminated by these seeds and can no longer then claim that their crops are organic because it's been contaminated? Has that happened as well?
Yes. The instance I'm thinking about right now was a farmer from Kansas, I believe, who was suing because Japan would not import his product anymore because Japan had heard that there was, GMO contamination in various places in this country. So then he was suing, saying, well, I this is my livelihood, and I can't sell my product. Percy Schmeiser's, this Canadian farmer, right, with canola, where he had bred his own variety for 50 years, and some GMO canola, literally blew into his field from a neighbor, and Monsanto sued. He had never bought the seed. He had never signed an agreement with Monsanto, nothing. And yet they were allowed to come into his field and then do tests and sue him. But meanwhile, he lost the crop that he had bred for 50 years. So this is a story. You wouldn't, when you hear a story like you say, how is this even possible? And in fact, Monsanto won in court, on technicalities. In the end, it was eventually overturned, but it's only because Percy Schmeiser kept fighting and was the kind of, he was actually a local politician and he wasn't going to give up. The problem actually comes down to a 1992 ruling during the first Bush administration that ruled that genetically engineered crops were substantially equivalent, that's the terminology, were substantially equivalent to traditional crops. And that ruling and all other, cases of law following on from that are determined by that ruling. It's never been changed. In fact, it's totally false. They are not substantially equivalent, and that's fairly easy to prove. But our U.S. law is based upon that ruling. Dang.
Now, a lot of people who are in favor of GMO food say, we are heading towards a planet with 9 billion people, and there's going to be no way to feed all those people unless we genetically engineer crops, for example, and they usually trot out the idea of this... rice that is very high in vitamin A content. And they say, with this we can, deal with the nutritional deficiencies that are coming down the pike. What's your answer to them? Do we need to do a deal with the devil just to feed the 9 billion, or is there an alternative model?
Well, I think it's a smokescreen, to be quite honest. I mean, it's the newest tech. We're always searching for the newest technology. And, you know, boy, it was difficult to write the chapter about all of this because it's, again, you know, it could be 10 books, you know, just to discuss how this has been laid out, you know, over the decades, because if you have to really go back to the 20s, you know, to the 1920s to sort of lay this whole thing out. But the smokescreen is that, you know, this happened with the Green Revolution, as it was called, which was called, you know, that was the technological fix at the time. And this was what it would take to feed the world. And in fact, that isn't what happened at all. I mean, almost as soon as it was rolled out, it turned out that what was really happening is that U.S. corporations were, you know, profiting from something that wasn't producing the wasn't feeding the masses as was the case, and exactly what's happening with GMOs. But in fact, there have been trials done over a long enough period of time now, because the Rodale research farm has been doing trials side by side of conventional crops and organic crops for quite a long time now, and has shown that although oftentimes the organic crops don't show the same kind of yield, because it often comes down to yield, don't show the same kind of yield, that eventually over a period of years they do, and in fact often show greater yields.
And hasn't the introduction of the GMO seeds also, I mean, it hasn't exactly solved the problem of poverty among, say, India's farmers?
Well, no, it's led in the other direction. No, that's very true. And I just want to mention Vandana Shiva's name, because she's the great spokesperson for the Indian farmers and really for, you know, the non-GMO movement throughout the world, basically. So.
And she has a seed bank that she is developing with women farmers in India.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a nice segue into a conversation about seed saving, which is such an important part of what you write about in this book, Scott Chasky, and In Seed Time. the practice, I believe, if I've pronounce it correctly, is Baranaja.
Yeah, right.
Tell us what Baranaja is and why Vandana Shiva says this is so connected to food democracy.
It's a way of actually broadcasting different varieties of plants that can enhance one another. It's the opposite of monocrop farming. So, and it's obviously, you know, builds on the concept of creating more diversity. And perhaps this can't be done on a huge scale in the breadbasket of the United States, but it can be done and feed a lot of people on smaller scales. And that is what's happening in places like India and in other places. But she's also re-educating, well, just just understand the concept of industrial agriculture coming in with new seeds that have to be purchased by indigenous farmers every year, so therefore it's more costly. And then to make the seeds work, they have to, you know, buy the pesticides or herbicides that go with it, and the companies are profiting from that, etc. And the opposite is what Vandana Shiva is doing, which is keeping alive the traditions that have existed in the country of dealing with diversity and of saving seeds and passing on that knowledge. That's really what she's doing. Yeah.
As you point out, there are 1,000 seed banks, that there's a whole revival in seed saving. What, let's say if somebody listening to this program might want to participate in seed saving, where would they go? What would they do?
Well, I would look, I mean, the I would look locally, and you know, I first talk to a local farmer, or you know, you could probably find something out from your local extension. You know, if you're in touch with one of the land grant universities, you go to a national source, which is the Seed Savers Exchange, and be linked through their catalog to over 13,000 varieties in this yearly catalog, and be linked to Seed Savers all over the country. And you'd find out pretty quickly that who was saving seeds locally, because they're listed in the Seed Savers Exchange catalog. I think that's probably a great source. You know, I met a wonderful couple at the NOFA New York Winter Conference who have newly started something called Fruition Seeds, and their whole impetus is to create a seed source, a local seed source for the New York area. You know, they're upstate New York, and perhaps New England if you wanted to extend it into a region. But really, you're going to have the best luck with plants that have been bred in your local environment. And so, I mean, I think there's enough information out there that anybody can find out about it if they do a little searching.
The soil, which receives the seed, you have a very beautiful passage in the book about soil and turning it over. I'd like to ask you to read it, if you'd like.
I begin with this passage because, more than any other, it evokes the very bodily joy of turning the earth and of the calling from the air, the stars, the soil to do so. I am reminded of a familiar feeling of resting on the handle of a spade and looking back on the deep brown earth newly spaded over in a garden on Boar's Hill, Oxford, and of lifting the rich soil of Penwith, Cornwall, with each dip of the long-handled shovel, dropping the handle onto my thigh just above the knee to throw the soil up the steep incline, working as a plow across and back the contour of the compact cliff meadow, and of bending down to lift a palmful of Amagansett silt loam from the furrow after the chisel plow has first opened the soil in April, noting the shine on the steel shanks. To raise a crop with some success and to husband a plant to produce ripe fruit, a gardener or farmer needs to know the soil in changing weather, the character and adaptability of the seed, and how to prepare a seed bed. The soil is mineral matter, and when nourished, it is alive with micro and macro fauna and seeds native to the place, deposited by previous plant species, by wind, by passing birds. A farmer comes to sense the pulse of life within the soil, and in spring, the song rises up, calling for seeds. It is time to invest in the earth, to lower the plow, to introduce the soil again to the air, to loosen and ply apart the contraction of winter. The seed bed should be clean and fine to ensure germination, organic matter given over, folded in from the previous season to enrich the soil that receives the seed.
That's so beautiful. Well, it is a beautiful book and an important book on many levels. Seed Time, and Scott Chesky, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was poet and organic farmer Scott Chesky, author of Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, published by Rodale Press. Sustainable East End is heard at this time each month on WPKN. Missed a show? Don't despair. Go online at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com to access our archives. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.